Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com. Hey y'all, you want to hang out? Because we are doing a live episode of the Sex with Simmery podcast. It is happening Saturday, September 5th at 6 p.m. So that's 9-5 at 6 p.m. And this is happening at Tattooed Mom on South Street in Philadelphia, where a lot of the parts of the Philly Podcast Festival are happening. And that's what this live episode is a part of. It's the Philly Podcast Festival. This is our third year. It's amazing. The last 2 years have been incredibly fun. You should come and check it out because it's awesome and because it's free. And I have two guests. I have Joey Martini of the Peekaboo Review, and I have Brittany Lynn of Brittany Lynn's Drag Mafia, the amazing drag queen from Philly. It stands to reason this is going to be ridiculously fun. I would expect nothing short of amazeballs. So come on out. It's part of the Philadelphia Podcast Festival. Again, Saturday, September 5th at 6 p.m. Tattooed Mom, live Sex with Simmery episode. Come and hang out. Say hi. I'll see you there. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am very excited to introduce to you Martha Kempner. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fabulous. My podcast producer made cookies, so I'm great. That's actually like the highlight of my moment. But yeah, we're going to talk about some sexy stuff that other than cookies. So one of the things that brought you to my attention is you're writing about the Kaya. Am I saying it correctly?
You know, I don't actually know. I've only seen it in print.
Oh, okay.
But that's how I'd say it.
Okay. So what are we talking about? What is this?
So it's the first new diaphragm to come on the market in over 50 years, and it's made out of silicone, what's unique about it, what's different about it from kind of the diaphragms that at least I learned about in high school and college, is that it is one size fits all. So it used to be that if you wanted a diaphragm, you had to go into your gynecologist, and they had to kind of size you, which literally meant putting one in, taking it out, putting another in, and seeing which one fit you best. And now this one is supposed to be one size fits all, so you don't have to worry about that, which is good, because the other thing that happened with the ones that needed to be sized were that if you gained or lost 10 pounds, you needed a different one. You probably needed a new size. So this will last longer. It also has a tab on it that's supposed to make it easier to put in and take out.
So you are a sexual health writer. You've been doing this for a little bit. Like, where do you think that this innovation stands in terms of, like, innovations in birth control methods that you've seen in your professional career?
Right. My professional career, that lasts longer than I think it should, because I shouldn't be old enough to measure things in decades. You know, it's interesting because we don't really talk about the diaphragm anymore. It's really lost a lot of popularity. People think it's kind of messy because you have to use it with some spermicidal jelly, and you have to be pretty comfortable with your body to put it in and take it out, because you really do have to stick it, you know, high up into your vagina. So it'll be interesting to see if this sparks a renewed interest in the diaphragm. My guess is in this country where there are so many other options, it's not going to be that big of an innovation, but in the developing world where some people are really far from a provider, being given something that they can use for 3 years without ever having to see a provider again is a really great innovation. So I think here it might not kind of set the world on fire and change everything, but other places it's going to make a big difference for women who want to prevent pregnancies.
One of the really big advantages of a diaphragm over, like, let's just say, like, an IUD or something, which is another thing that would last for many years. There certainly are non-hormonal IUDs, but there are a lot of folks who don't want to be putting in hormones into their bodies, and or maybe they can't, and that sort of thing. So a diaphragm, you know, is a good option in terms of that. What do you think about effectiveness compared to other methods, though?
Well, that's the problem. I don't know that there's ever been or I don't know what the effectiveness rating for Kaya itself has been seen as, but the diaphragm is pretty low down on the list in terms of effectiveness rating, and there's a few reasons for that. One is if it doesn't fit you properly, you know, sperm are pretty little and they can get around the side of it. It's literally creating a barrier between the sperm and the cervix. And so if it's not in right or it's not fitting right, it can not work. The bigger part of the efficacy issue with diaphragms is not using it. And that's the part that we have problems with whenever we talk about user failure rates for contraception, because what happens is the harder it is to use, and by hard I don't mean difficult necessarily, I mean it takes your attention and your action, right? So with the diaphragm, you have to put it in before you have sex. And a lot of people often, you know, it stays in the night table drawer because the heat of the moment comes on you pretty fast and you think, I could get up and put my diaphragm in, or I could just not. And so I think that's really one of the problems, is the more interaction you have to do with your own birth control method, the more likely there is to be to mess up. And so the thing about the IUD, where, you know, yes, some of them do have hormones, but you put them in and you are protected from pregnancy almost, you know, close to 100% without doing anything for somewhere between 3 and 10 years. So that's, I mean, those are pretty good odds.
Yeah. I mean, it's just good to have more options because there's, you know, there's an endless variety of experiences in the way that people experience sexuality and their health issues and those sort of things. So I think it's great that we're continuing to do research into more and more options. We've got mostly ones that women are responsible for. How are we doing on the male front?
Well, we keep talking about that elusive male birth control pill. And I've done some writing on the efforts to make one or to make. So far, the thing that has come closest is a gel that would be injected and block the vas deferens, which is where sperm come out of. And so it's not permanent. It's reversible, unlike a vasectomy, which also blocks the vas deferens, but it requires a shot in the testicles. And so far, they're coming up with other ways to do it, but this is what they've come up with so far. So people haven't really jumped on that idea. But I think, you know, there is the condom, which is tried and true and better than we like to give it credit for. How's that for? Yeah. I think, you know, we think about condoms, we often think about them as the first method that people use. And in fact, the CDC just released some data that suggests that it is the first method that most people use the very first time they have sex. If they're going to use a method, they use a condom, and that's great. And even better, if they use a condom the first time they have sex, they're going to be more likely to use a condom going forward and less likely to become pregnant as a teenager for women. So that's also really important. So we should remember how important they are as a birth control method. We should also remember that they're the only method of contraception that can provide protection against STDs. But also, they're not what they used to be. They're much thinner. There's a lot of different shapes on the market. There's some, for example, that have kind of a bulbous, not a good word, I know, but wider at the top than at the bottom, and lubricated on the inside and the outside. And the theory with those is that the penis kind of slides around inside of it in addition to being in the vagina, and that mimics sex without a condom more so than the more traditional tighter condoms. And then there are some that, you know, have bumps and ridges and warming and cooling lubricants on them. And I mean, there's just a lot of things that you can go out and play with, and maybe some of the condoms would make sex even better with them without a condom.
Yeah.
And you know what my favorite thing is?
What's that?
Which is, comes with the condom. It's not exactly part of the condom. Vibrating rings?
Ah, yes.
Yes, the vibrating ring. So a couple of the condom companies make a vibrating ring where you you can put the condom on and then you put the vibrating ring on top of it and it kind of turns the penis into a sex toy.
Well, I mean, more of one.
Into a battery operated.
Ah, yes.
Which it wasn't to begin with.
But then there's also, you know, we got the custom fit condoms now. So like for those who have, you know, there's like the ads about your special eyes. Well, what if you have a special dick and you need a special condom? You can get them custom made for your exact size. And that's delightful because now you don't have to worry about like, so a regular condom might be too big and it doesn't stay on, or a regular condom feels too tight and then it's restrictive and it's uncomfortable, and or you have, you know, particular dimensions that are just outside of what is average, and there are more options now.
Yeah, I think that's great too. I mean, the truth is that, you know, traditional condoms fit most people, but for people who they don't fit, it's really unpleasant, and that's been a reason to not use condoms. And, you know, if you're either needing condoms for birth control or you're needing them for STI protection, then it's great that you have this option of getting ones that are custom made. Maybe they have your name on them.
Ooh. Oh, man, I want one that has my name on it.
Yeah, I made that up, but I'm sure we could start a business.
I'm going to totally do that. I'm going to totally do that. That's a good idea.
It would be scary, though, if you had one that had your partner's name on it, and then if you switch partners, you can't use the old box at all.
Well, I mean, that's sort of like an ongoing, like, okay, so this is an aside, but all right, so you use toys with this person, whatever, and then you break up, and then, like, do you have to get rid of those toys?
Ooh, good question. I mean, you clearly have to wash them really carefully, but I'd say they're yours. You keep them.
Yeah, and this might be more of, like, a women who have sex with women kind of question, because I think they're more likely to have an emotional attachment to the place that the toy exists in the relationship, that it has a much more like, this was our dildo, like, versus like, this is just mine.
You know, if that is the case, then fresh start.
Yeah.
You know, a fresh start is, and shopping for toys is always fun. So why not?
For real. Speaking about innovations around condoms. So one of the things we chatted about discussing is not even a real thing. Doesn't even exist yet. Was a theoretical idea for a condom that could do STI testing. Do you want to let people know about that who might not be familiar?
Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, all over the news with these headlines about a condom that would change colors if your partner had an STD or if you had an STD. And the thing that struck me as crazy, and I did write a piece about this for RH Reality Check, was that the articles made it sound like this condom existed. And one of the great things was that a couple of teenagers, high school students in Britain, were the ones who had, you know, I'm using air quotes, you can't see them, but I'm using them, invented this condom, which is great. I think we want our teens to be inventive and take science seriously. And I think we want them to come up with great ideas and innovations for the future. But there's kind of two issues here. One is they didn't actually invent it. They had an idea, a kind of wouldn't it be great if, right? And so wouldn't it be great if there was a condom that could also tell you if you had an STD? In the same way that, like, I don't know, whenever I walk in the rain, I keep thinking, wouldn't it be great if my glasses had windshield wipers on them? Right? But that doesn't mean that I actually invented glasses with windshield wipers on them. They never figured out how to do this. There isn't a working prototype on how to do it. And the truth of the matter is that home STI tests, really at this point, you can take the samples at home, but for the most part, you have to send them to a lab to be analyzed. So it's not like the technology exists in another form and they figured out how to turn it into condoms. The technology really isn't there yet. So that's first of all. But my other problem with it is really, I don't know that it's a good idea. Like, I don't think lying naked in bed with someone, remember, you're putting on a condom midway through. You're not like walking into the room with the condom already on. That's one thing. The condom can't really react until it comes into contact with either vaginal secretions or semen, because that's where the STI bacteria for the most part are. So you're going to be in the middle of this sex act before your condom turns purple and you look at your partner and say, you gave me gonorrhea? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like the best moment for that. I think you want all that to have happened before the sex. And also, you know, all joking aside, it actually to me seemed like almost a potentially dangerous moment for that. If someone was, you know, not in a safe relationship, or it just seems to me like those discussions need to take place when you're less vulnerable.
There was also a critique that I read that it had to do, essentially that it was for the benefit of whoever was wearing the condom, that like basically their assumption was, because again, it doesn't exist, but their assumption was that this was basically just like kind of a dipstick, and it's basically testing the person that, you know, the condom's going into, as opposed to being able to reveal what's going on the inside of it. And in that way would be,
you know, uneven. I think in theory it was supposed to be equal for both partners, though in practice semen probably doesn't happen till the very end of the sex act, whereas vaginal fluids happen earlier. So you could dipstick, as you say it. That's a great image. Now remembering when my father taught me how to check the oil in my first car. But so you could, you know, it could be a dipstick and only tell you about the penetrated partner, but it could, and then at the end, I guess, after, you know, after the partner who's doing the penetration has an orgasm, then you can see whether they have an STD. So there is an imbalance there a little bit, but I think it was meant to be equal. I mean, I think the other thing that I think is so interesting about this is it was a science fair project. Literally, it was a science fair project. And they won some money for it. And in October, they're going to go to Buckingham Palace and get their prize. And I think that's fabulous. But we heard about it. All of us heard about this science fair project, which suggests to me that there's something, that people want something. People are looking for innovation in condoms, in birth control in general. People are fascinated. I mean, obviously, sex sells, right? So it's going to be, you know, a better condom, I'm sorry, a better science fair project than the exploding volcano or whatever. But although that probably was a bad visual. But I think it just shows us that we're looking for innovation in birth control. We've had these methods that are out there for a really long time, and people are wondering what's next. I do worry a little bit that we've forgotten to take a look at what we've already done with condoms, as an example, or even with LARCs, long-acting reversible contraception, IUDs, and implants, because we have made some progress in the last few years.
What are some of those that people should know about?
Well, so, I mean, I think that the progress is really in terms of the acceptance of both IUDs and implants. They both have a pretty tricky history. I don't, you know, if we want to go back a little bit, in the 70s, there were about 22 models of IUD on the market. And then one of the models, the Dalcon Shield, had some issues, and pretty serious issues. It was bad design, and women died from it. Basically, what happened was they got, first of all, it didn't work as well as others, but it also allowed bacterial to get into the uterus in a way that the other IUDs didn't, and people got pelvic inflammatory disease. So some women became infertile because of it, and a few women did die because of it. And it was, and rightly so, a very big deal. But what happened was that for decades, pretty much everybody stopped using IUDs. The medical community said no one should use them unless they've had kids already and don't want any more. And that really limited, you know, the clientele. And it really limited women's options, because apart from this one very poorly designed IUD, they really were a good option that had been around for a long time. So in the last 10 years or so, we've maybe a little bit longer, we've had new IUDs on the market, and they're safe, they're effective, they're very effective. And so it's been a gradual shift in public opinion, I think, is really what's going on. And it's not just public opinion, it's also provider opinion. It's taken a long time to get people to understand that they really are safe and kind of get over the past history of them. And so they're getting, you know, they're still lagging way behind the pill when you look at how many people or the percentage of people who use contraception who are using IUDs, but they are definitely increasing in popularity, and they are definitely increasing in popularity in young people.
Yeah. That's the really big thing, is that like the Pediatric Association came out with a pretty clear stance that like IUDs actually make the most sense for teenagers. Yep. Because like they're not actually super great at taking a pill the exact same time every day. Because they're teenagers. So like,
and the implant too, I think some teenagers are more comfortable with the implant, which is basically, you know, releasing the same hormones as in birth control, but it goes on the inside of your arm and does it for 3 years. And I think both of those are methods that you set them and forget them, right? You put them in, and they are a really good option for teenagers who forget to take their pill a lot or don't use a condom every time they have sex. And I think that that's, you know, I think the new focus on them is both fabulous, and I get a little tiny bit worried about it.
So one of the things that is less commonly discussed that we definitely should talk about while we're talking about contraceptive methods, because people, you know, still write me all the time asking about this as a valid method, withdrawal. What are your thoughts?
Well, here's the complicated thing about withdrawal. If you look at research and you look just at the efficacy rates, and efficacy rates on contraception are, they're not hugely complicated, but the way they're presented is hugely complicated. But so I think that people do get confused by looking at them. And the only thing I want to say here is that every method kind of has two efficacy rates, right? The perfect one, if you use it exactly as you're supposed to and you have all the control in the world and you never mess up, and the real world one based on what actually happens with a lot of couples. And so the thing about withdrawal is that if you actually look at the efficacy rate, especially the real world one, they're on par with some other methods like diaphragms and condoms. But there are some caveats to that, and it makes me nervous as a sex educator. It makes me nervous if someone's really going to use that as a method, and I will give you a couple of reasons why. The first is this age-old debate over whether there is sperm in pre-cum. So I'm not sure when you went to grad school, but it's been back and forth. I think it actually seems to have started with Masters and Johnson, who said there were sperm in pre-cum, and then couldn't tell anybody where they got that information from and how they had tested it. So, but for decades and decades and decades, all of us sexuality educators would say, hey, you can't use withdrawal as a method because there's sperm in pre-cum, so you could get pregnant even if he withdraws. And then there was some research that came out however many years ago that said, actually, no. There is no sperm in pre-cum. So we kind of had to stop using that argument. But now the latest research basically says that for some men, there is sperm in pre-cum, and for some men, there isn't. And you have absolutely no way of knowing which category your partner falls into. So there is that risk with using the pull and pray method. The other risks are... And it's not a trust issue. I'm not suggesting that your partner would say that he would do it and deliberately not do it. But people have to know their body in order to do this correctly. And they may not know their body. And they may not be able to every time have the control to pull out before they come. And then, of course, there's the issue that it doesn't protect against STIs at all. And so I think, you know, if you're in a log cabin and you have absolutely no other method of contraception with you, it's definitely better than nothing. And it's prevented a hell of a lot of pregnancies over the millennia, I'm sure. But for the most part, most people here have access to better methods that can, you know, prevent pregnancy better and also prevent STIs.
Cool. So you have been, you've been writing about sexuality for a while. Where all can people find your writing, and they can learn more from you and stay up to date on all of the latest things?
Yeah, so I write for RH Reality Check, which is a online news site dedicated to reproductive health, so you can check me out there. And then I just wrote a new book that came out in April. I wrote it with a sociologist called Pepper Schwartz, called Named, A Friend. And the book is called 50 Great Myths of Human Sexuality. So we go through all of the things that people might believe are true that really aren't. And some of them are about birth control. In fact, there's a whole one dedicated to withdrawal.
All right. I find withdrawal like a super interesting topic because, like, I mean, yeah, like you mentioned, like it depends on when you learned about this stuff. My understanding when I was trained was that it was like the issue wasn't necessarily that pre-cum had ejaculated, but that like you have previously ejaculated and there's probably just still some bullets in the chamber.
Right.
It was just
well,
that
the
kind
interesting
of idea.
Thing about this study was that they had men. They had men urinate in between giving samples, mm-hmm. and what so that that would have essentially washed out the chamber, as you say. And it didn't make a difference for mm-hmm. some men, mm-hmm. even though they'd done that. There was still sperm, and for some men that there weren't.
Ah, interesting. Cool. So people should check you out. What about social media stuff? You want to send people towards your Twitter or anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. I'm at Martha Kempner on Twitter, and I try to tweet. I should tweet more.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. And have a fantastic day. Hey, y'all. You want to hang out? Because we are doing a live episode of the Sex with Simmery podcast. It is happening Saturday, September 5th at 6 p.m. So that's 9-5. At 6 p.m. And this is happening at Tattooed Mom on South Street in Philadelphia, where a lot of the parts of the Philly Podcast Festival are happening. And that's what this live episode is a part of. It's the Philly Podcast Festival. This is our third year. It's amazing. The last 2 years have been incredibly fun. You should come and check it out because it's awesome and because it's free. And I have two guests. I have Joey Martini of the Peekaboo Review, and I have Brittany Lynn of Brittany Lynn's Drag Mafia, the amazing drag queen from Philly. It stands to reason that this is going to be ridiculously fun. I would expect nothing short of amazeballs. So come on out. It's part of the Philadelphia Podcast Festival. Again, Saturday, September 5th at 6 p.m. Tattooed Mom, live Sex with Simmery episode. Come and hang out. Say hi. I'll see you there. Thank you for listening to Sex with Simmery. Please check out more from sexwithtimmery.com, where Monday through Friday there's new content, including polls, weekly sex columns, and Friday sex links. And if you have any questions, comments, or violent reactions, please email them to sexwithtimmery@gmail.com. That's sexwithtimmare@gmail.com. And thank you.